Welcome to the Storyfield Podcast. This is Josh Allen, and I'm joined by my co-host, Micah Petrie. We both know that life is complex. We know that business is hard, and living a life of faith can really feel complicated. It is discouraging when movement in your life or business or faith has stopped. Well, you're in the right place to hear some great stories of normal people that are going to inspire you to take a step and move forward in life. So thank you for joining us. Today, you will be encouraged. Today, I'm really excited for a few reasons. First, this is Storyfield's very first episode. And our guest today is Craig Couch, who's my friend and someone I greatly look up to and really consider a mentor in business and life, whether he knows it or not. So thank you, Craig. Craig's been married 25 years. He's the dad of two 20-somethings that are out of the house, I think. So he's the founder and owner of at least five businesses that I'm aware of right now. And I'm sure there's many more, and they're all located in the Fort Worth area.
How do you have enough time for five businesses? That's crazy.
Yeah, it's not easy.
Yeah, so we have Indwell Real Estate. We have Merit Mortgage. We have Casa Dueña Adueño. Is that right? Did I pronounce that right? We have Clutch Lending, his newest venture, and Advocate Ventures. So did I get them all, Craig?
Yes.
So, hey, welcome and thank you. Thank you. What an honor that we have you on today. So thank you.
I'm happy to be here. I love it. I really appreciate you inviting me, and I'm really flattered, actually. And I know your heart behind this, and I know it's going to help a bunch of people, and I just admire you for that.
Thank you.
I think we'll send you a plaque as being the number one guest on the Storyfield.
Yep. So great.
I'll help you do that, Micah.
We'll do it. So you grew up in McAllen. So I want to hit a little bit of your background, and then I want to dive into some stuff that I think can really help people who are listening to this. So tell us a little bit about growing up in McAllen, which is at the very bottom of Texas. Is that right?
Yeah. And then actually the town was, we lived outside of an even smaller town called Alamo, Texas. And it was so close to the border that I could crawl up my roof and see Mexico. And it was really interesting because I actually grew up as a minority. My high school had 3,500 kids in it, and I was one of a dozen gringos.
Wow.
All Hispanic, no African American, zero. Actually, there were two, and they were only 50-50. And they were my best buddies, actually, and still close to them to this day. But it was a crazy place to live in a border town like that. But speak fluent Spanish as a result, which is part of the story that's woven into the market we serve. And it was one of the reasons that we went towards that market, because I was able to communicate with, Hispanic people in North Texas.
What border town was right across? Were you across?
Reynosa. Reynosa was right across the way. And it was, in high school, it was wheels off. Like I worry about my kids a little bit, but I was actually I wasn't just sneaking out of the house. I was sneaking out of the country.
Yeah. It was a little bit, open to go across whenever.
It was totally safe too. I mean, it was no big deal.
I was gonna say, when's the last time you were in McAllen?
Oh, I go down all the time. My dad bought this beautiful ranch. He sold his business and bought this great ranch down in South Texas called the Star K Ranch. And it's fantastic. It's a 1,000-acre high fence ranch, and he just spends all his time down there. So I go down there once a month.
Awesome. The only reason I'm asking that question is, where is the best in the whole place to eat if you're in McAllen?
Oh, well, so I don't ever go to McAllen anymore.
Oh.
I stop north of there. So I haven't, that's a good question. I go once a month, but I'm going out.
You never make it that far. You stay up north.
No,
I gotcha.
No, but I can, if people travel down there, there's some great places to eat, but like, gosh, it's been 10 plus years since I've had a dinner in McAllen. Mm.
So. I was trying to do like a Craig's Diner and Drive there, but
my sister lives there. She sent me a list recently, so I have to look that up, and maybe you can put it in the show notes because
nice, great.
I mean, some legit Mexican food down there, obviously.
Yeah, well, we noticed that one of your sports was surfing. That was one of your things. So did not pick that up in South Texas, right? I mean, where did you get the love for?
Well, actually, I did. So in high school, before I got my driver's license, every summer growing up, we would be down at South Padre Island. And the surf is flat in the summertime, unless there's a hurricane and or a tropical storm. And on the either side of those storms, the surf is incredible. And in the wintertime, we get good swells. So I actually surfed on a surf team, believe it or not, and traveled up and down the coast in the winter months in the high school. And I was on a team of 5 or 6 guys, and we competed against other surf shops. And I surfed for Team Isla, which is still in business today. It's not really a surf shop anymore. But it's still a clothing store, and Vern Lewis is the owner, and he was the coach. And this was back in 1989, you know, back in
the day. That is awesome.
That is great.
So, there's some really good waves, but you kind of have to live there because it's really spotty. But when it's good, it's really good. And it gets overhead, and it's legit. There's a break inside of the jetties called Dolphin Cove and Boca Chica on the other side. We call it Barracuda Cove. And those spots are really good. When the swell is really, really high and blown out, it blows between the jetties. And it's perfect left comes off and a good left in Boca Chica. But you have to paddle all the way across the ship channel. I spent lots of time in Hawaii, did a bunch of trips down to Costa Rica, surfed this spot called Pavones, which is one of the longest lefts in the world. It's so long that when you're done riding the wave, you get out and hike back to the point. It's a point break.
Now, was that in Costa Rica?
Uh-huh. I found out about it through that old 60s movie called Endless Summer. And I saw these guys surfing. They just kept going and going. I'm like, I'm going there. And so in college, I talked my parents into me taking some Spanish classes down there. And I took Spanish classes for 3 weeks. And then for the next 3 months, I surfed. And I had it was me, my backpack and surfboard and tent and sleeping bag and cookware. And, you know, and every once in a while, I'd stay in a hotel for about $6 a night, believe it or not. And had an adventure on my own. So, and I've been back and I took my daughter down there for a month when she turned 13, and we stayed down there for a month, and I surfed the same spot actually just real close called Matapala. But anyway, surfing is a love of mine, and I'm landlocked here in Cowtown, and that's okay.
Yeah. So Costa Rica has to be your favorite place then, like your favorite place for that sport.
No, I would say Hawaii is because it's unbeatable, but Costa Rica is fun because I get to practice my Spanish and all that. It's way more. But I would say Hawaii is better. It's just world famous, and to surf where the temperature is 82 degrees, the air is 82 and the water is 82. It's like you can't beat it.
Well, let's so high school growing up. You did not grow up in the faith. You did not grow up in church. Is that right? Tell us a little bit about
I kind of did. I became a Christian when I was 15 through the church camp experience. But it really, I mean, God really grabbed my heart at that moment. So I did grow up going to church, but didn't really understand until I was about 15. And then I started to really understand that that was kind of the inflection point in my life, actually, just really launched into my faith at 15.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit, cause I know a little bit about just your history. But tell me a little bit about your family life growing up and, you know, your dad and.
Yeah. I mean, I had a really stable family life, for a with there being a divorce in the midst. You know, my dad moved out when I was in fourth grade. My parents got divorced about that time, which is a tough time. I mean, it's never a good time to have a divorce in your family. It just sucks. There's just no way to, you can't cut it any other way. It just sucks. But, you know, my dad, he was only a few miles away, which is really cool. And I got to see him, you know, every other weekend, and every Tuesday was the deal.
Yeah.
But it was really hard as a 10-year-old, you know, a 9 or 10-year-old, however old you are when you're in fourth grade, to not have your dad at home. And, you know, it's so interesting because I felt like I was this, in a way, I became sort of this, sort of weird to say it this way, but sort of like the husband to my mom and then the dad to my little brother, Kurt, who was 4 years younger. You know, I mean, that poor guy was 5 years old. And so upon further reflection, really, I've realized that tough, rough spot in my life created quite a bit of my self-reliance. Because I have a ton of it. And it's actually an Achilles heel of mine of not needing God, because I'm like, I got this, you know. So it's definitely a struggle, but at the same time, it's fuel to, you know, Michael, you asked a little bit ago, you know, how do you have the energy to do all this, or how do you have the time? And it's just the drive. The drive, a lot of it came from that period in my life. As I've matured and grown older, you know, I realize that a lot of that fortitude and determination and self-reliance came from growing up real fast without really wanting to, but did. And it's just the reality of my life, but God's really used it quite a bit.
So. Yeah, my parents got divorced when I was little, and I kind of had a little extra grit and resilience kind of built into me just because of that situation, and not even have to, you know, not even really have to do anything. It just was there, I guess, from the visuals of me seeing what was going on. And I always tried to, you know, my grandpa was the one that ended up raising me. Yeah. And I was always the one that, I was always trying to impress him, which I guess we all do. We all kind of take our dads to a different level and try to, you know, be them, or make sure they're the ones that are super proud of us, even though we get along with our moms better, or at least I did. Yeah. But anyway, that's cool, man.
Yeah. You know, PSJ junior high was dicey, man. It was rough. And I'm a skinny little white kid all by myself. Just seriously, like it was, there were times where I was fearing for my life because I looked at a guy wrong that just towered over me. He's all hairy and just weird. And here I'm just, I weigh like a buck 05. I got nothing on these people, a lot of them. And so I felt really threatened a lot. And so there, I don't know, man, this resilience that's developed in me was just really in those formidable years.
A
lot of things formed then. I'm not afraid of many people. I'm just not.
Well, tell those dads and families. I mean, cause you know, we're an attorney firm. So we deal a lot with, you know, those family law and divorce situations, but encourage those dads or those, you know, those moms who are listening and have been through that and feel like, hey, my kid is ruined, you know, or it's over for them. I mean, you're a living story of like all that has been woven into ultimate good for you and for your character and for what you've done. But do you have any encouragement for those parents?
Yeah, I mean, I would just encourage them to have hope and stay connected, you know, stay engaged and stay connected. And really, you know, I was lucky because my dad was engaged. I mean, he showed up to the games and, you know, my parents were sitting separate in the bleachers. They weren't sitting next to each other or anything, but you know, they kept, I guess they kept a good connection with my brother and I, and did a good job. I mean, it was what it was, and I think they navigated it well because they didn't make it about them. Because if they would have made about them, then I would have suffered more. But they made it a little bit more like, hey, let's make sure the boys feel supported and loved. And, you know, I may not love you or like you anymore or want to be around you, want to look at you, but it's about the boys, right? And so my encouragement is to, you know, take the, you know, to take the, set aside all of the parts that make it about you and your ex, would be my input, because that my parents didn't do that. And it seemed to help. It at least provided a little bit of stability for me.
That's good, Craig. Thank you. Mm-hmm. So fast forward, you head off to Texas Tech, mm-hmm. which is a long way away from your hometown.
Yeah. 12-hour drive.
Did you make that often?
Yeah, I had an old, like I had a 1982 straight six Land Cruiser with a crappy AC. And, you know, it got like 11 miles a gallon and it was just like, oh my gosh, it's so long. But I had been accepted to A&M and was signed up for fish camp, the whole thing. I was going to be an Aggie at the last minute for whatever reason. God save me from that. and what I mean by that is, you know, I love Aggies. I've got Aggies that work for me and they're the best, actually. I've hired Aggie before a Longhorn all day long.
Yeah.
Sorry about that. 100%. Anyway, I feel like, you know, I felt rescued because that's where I met Jennifer. I met her my freshman year and, I was like, oh, okay, this is why. And I love West Texas and had a great time, great experience there. Graduated in 4 years with a degree in computer programming. I was the dumbest kid in class.
I was going to ask you about your MIS degree because I didn't know that about you. That actually surprised me. Knowing you for the time period I have, it surprised me that you were a computer.
Like, I had to lean on my social skills 100% to get through that. But once I you know, decided to go management information systems or, you know, computer, basically business computer programming, I couldn't turn back. And I was like, man, I mean, I graduated with 146 hours in 4 years.
Wow.
Crazy intense.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I met my bride as well my freshman year at Texas Tech. So apparently it's a good place to meet your spouse.
Oh, man. And she's a Lubbock girl.
So, oh, okay.
I mean, they're just... I don't know, man. She's salt of the earth, and the sexiest.
I still
one of the
love
sexiest things
Texas.
About her is the one of the sexiest things about Jennifer is that she's frugal.
Mm.
I think that's so hot, man.
Yeah.
She starts going finding stuff on sale and just like bragging about how cheap she got stuff. I'm like, man, you're hot.
It's awesome. A helpful partner. Yeah. Okay, so you graduate. Let's keep moving you down the time. And before we get into like the businesses right now, you've never told me about this, and I guess I should have known, but I wanted to ask you, at what point did you own an Orbis store? So I've never heard that in our communications, you know, in our story.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. I so all through tech, I worked at the Mountain Hideaway. So that was the store, and I was actually there right when it started. And Kyle Jones, a great friend of mine. Still keep in touch with him. And
well, you need to tell him that's where I got my first pair of Native sunglasses, and I still have those things. I love those things. So
yeah. So Kyle and I are great buddies, and I was there when he was in his early 20s and just was like a year into business. And all 4 years I worked like 30 hours a week there at Mountain Hideaway and fell in love with outdoor retail. And one of the guys that worked there moved to Fort Worth and was in seminary here at Southwestern. And anyway, he calls me one day and says, hey man, there's a shop here in Fort Worth, an Orbis dealership. A couple of attorneys started it and they thought they'd have their wives run it, and that it just got all catty and crapped out. Well, Mark was working for him and he called me. He's like, hey man, looks like they're about to just fold it up. I bet you could buy this inventory and take over the lease and just kill it. So I drive to Fort Worth. This time I had upgraded in a way, downgraded to a 72 FJ40 Land Cruiser with no doors.
That's my favorite.
Yeah.
Did you just get into the window or what? What did you sky roof or How'd you get in that?
It didn't have any doors. It didn't have any doors.
Oh, okay.
It had a bimini top, and that was it.
Okay.
Anyway, nice. It had a Chevy 350 conversion, so I could white smoke the tires. It was a worthless truck, but I loved it. Anyway, we were in Waco at the time, and I hop in the truck and head north, and I'm 22 years old, and I sit down with these high power railroad attorneys and strike a deal with them, and I buy their inventory at half of wholesale, and didn't
at
call
22.
Them. Yeah.
22 years old.
I borrowed 30 grand from my dad. And meanwhile, Jennifer's packing the U-Haul. We have no place to live. We know no one in Fort Worth. No one. And all I know is that 76107 has the highest catalog sales for the Orbis company in the country.
Wow. In this area.
I'm going to kill this. And we did. Just killed it. It was awesome. As such a young man. And I met every awesome, cool sportsman in Fort Worth the first year I was here. So I knew everybody right away. It was really fun. And I did that from 23 until I was 31. Built it to 3 locations. Had one in Sundance Square, one on the west side by Central Market, and then one in Colleyville. Just like I was trying to expand it. I was fed up with retail. I was like, this sucks. I don't want to do this anymore. It's a super inefficient way to make money. If any of the listeners out there are thinking about starting a retail company, come have lunch with me and I'll talk you out of it. It's terrible. Anyway.
What was so hard about it? Yeah.
Well,
what was so
hard? The margins are terrible. Like, yeah. it's just so brutal. I mean, terribly hard way to make a living because the hours are really tough and it's just the public and it's really hard. But anyway, I had to get it out of my system and I did. But I tried to build it to 3 locations so that I could sell it as a package, and the Colleyville location just killed me. And so,
was it because of the market? I mean, because of,
it was just early. Colleyville had good demographics, but it was just early. And you know, just, I'm young in business and totally isolated and trying to figure it out on my own. And don't really have any input from other people, and partly because I didn't know how to ask for it. And, you know, just made some really poor decisions. The banks kept lending me money. I couldn't believe it, but they would. And I got into really deep, deep debt, and it was bad debt. Because once I liquidated everything. I sent an email to my list of customers, and I liquidated everything in
from all 3 stores?
Yeah, in 72 hours.
Wow.
Dang.
Shelves clean, all of it done. So, which sounds cool, except for when the dust settled, I still owed $2 million.
Oh, my. But did you lead up to that decision, or was that just kind of a breaking point, like we're out, or was that a really well thought out plan of liquidation? Or is that kind of like you wake up on Monday and you're just like, I'm done. I'm, you know.
Okay, so let me back up. I'll tell you, that's a great question. So what actually happened was is that I knew that I was done with retail. And so in 2002, I bought my first investment real estate property, my first house to flip. And I partnered up with a guy named Lee Ellis, and he was in the retail business, and he and I would sing the blues about how crappy the business model is. And I'm like, dude, we need to get out of this business. And I gave him the book Rich Dad Poor Dad at the Paris coffee shop, and this was almost 20 years ago, and said, read this. He read it. We met again. I go, dude, we need to team up and do some real estate and get the hell away from this retail mess. He's like, I'm in. So we bought 2 houses on the courthouse steps like a month later or something like that. And we bought them like November, the first Tuesday in November of 2001 or something like that. And by January 1st, 2002, I think that's the date, we rehabbed and flipped both of them. And we made like 60 grand.
In like 2 months, 3 months.
Yeah. And we were like, we've solved our problems. And so this is it. This is easy.
Wow.
Like, oh my gosh, that's more than I netted this year in retail. Like, and I did it in 60 days. It was like, oh my gosh, this is the best. So anyway, that's what launched our real estate company. And so we started flipping houses and building it up in such a way that we could exit out of retail. And that's when I pulled the plug on retail, because okay. I had a little bit of cash. And
that's what led into really and started in Dwell Real Estate, which is now 20 years in the making, a year shy of 20 years in the making.
Yeah, that's it. Now, that's it. Yeah.
Give us a kind of the picture of where you guys are at now, as far as the real estate company, and then we'll want to kind of back in and fill in the gaps.
Okay. Yeah. So,
so you started with two houses on the courthouse step in November 2002.
Yeah. So we've bought, restored, and sold, 1,000 houses or more. It's at least 1,000 houses. And we've owner financed hundreds and hundreds of them. Because if you're a house flipper, you're not really an investor. You're just creating capital gains. And we knew that. So 2008, we switched to the owner finance model after trying rentals. We tried rentals. We were like, okay, let's buy one rental a month, for a year. And so we bought 12, high-end rentals and originally Country Club Estates all the way down to Section 8 stuff. To try it out, we decided we hated that. So we switched to the owner finance model, and started originating our own loans. And because we wanted that passive income, it's not really passive. It's technically, it's not passive. It's portfolio income, but we wanted to build a portfolio. And so that's what we've been working on, which is really difficult, but really, really awesome. And, our primary customer, primarily because of my background, is the unbankable or underbanked Hispanic families in North Texas.
That's awesome. I got a great idea for your sixth business. I'm going to pitch it to Discovery Plus, and we're going to create a show called Flipping with Craig.
You know, I've been approached to do the show, like a show on two different occasions, and I'm like, no.
Nope.
Well, dang it. You know, it's like I'm thinking, do I want to be on TV or do I want to build a business? Because you can't do both.
Yep.
I was like, nah, I'm not doing that. As I was thinking about how much time it would take, I'm like, nah, I'm out of my, I don't care.
You try to add, what kind of inventory, how many houses do you and Lee? So you and Lee are still partners.
Oh yeah.
You're still in this business together. How much inventory do you guys try to add each year?
So we try to add 80 a year.
Is kind 80 of houses.
Mm-hmm. 80 nodes, right? So, but recently it's been very difficult because inventories are low. And so we've had to pivot. And so another company we started is Indwell Homes, which wasn't in your list earlier.
Indwell Homes
builds new houses. So we build... we built 20 last this, you know, in 2020 and 2021, we'll build 30 is the goal. So we're buying infield lots on the east side. We're buying lots and developments, and we're building kind of low to moderate income housing. And they're beautiful. They're the coolest, cheapest houses you can imagine.
Yeah, I've seen pictures. They're gorgeous.
Yeah, they're cool. They're so cool. Because Lee... One of the things that's cool about Lee, and I'd never do this if it weren't for him, but he really pays attention to the details, especially with the design. I mean, I would make just a box and go for it, you know, just keep going. But he really takes a lot of pride in them. And at first I was like, yeah, we don't need to do that. Let's just, you know, and he's like, no, it needs to be. And he just made them really excellent. And so they're truly beautiful. They're so cool that they qualify for the historic area here in the Near East Side. Because they have the architectural integrity and they still remain good enough. Inexpensive enough for the low to moderate income market.
Isn't that interesting how God weaved your background, where you grew up, into what you're doing, which also, so Casa Dueño, and make sure I'm saying that right. I should practice.
Casa Dueño, Adueño is the name of the entity. So Casa Dueño, Adueño, that means homes owner to owner.
Okay.
Right? In the Hispanic market, they understand that that's what that means. There's a lot of shysters in that business that take advantage of this Hispanic market, including other Hispanic people. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a market that that gets the short end of the stick a lot. And we battle against that quite a bit. But we, you know, when we finish a house, we sell it. It just sells. We don't ever have a problem selling them, and we don't use realtors to sell them. We just sell them. We have a Facebook page that has 25,000 followers on there. We post the house on there and it sells.
Dang, selling by Facebook.
Yeah.
Yes.
In Spanish.
Yeah. I mean, you guys have done it. So the your real estate agency, tell me how they fit into that business fits into the picture.
Yeah. So Indwell Real Estate is a real, I call it a passion project. You know, I just look at the real estate brokerage model and it's just broken. I mean, the days of the old school broker that gets to take, you know, half the commission of the agent is slowly but surely disappearing because the market doesn't allow it. You know, people are, the real estate world is very emotional, but it's also at the same time becoming very automated. Mm-hmm. And so the need for an agent in the market's eyes, even though it's not true, but in the market's eyes is going down and going down. And so if you were going to sell your house, the likelihood of you wanting a discount from the listing agent that you've hired is pretty high. Because you're gonna want a deal. Like, I'm gonna give you this listing, but I don't want to pay you 3% to list it. Well, the problem with that is that the agent then is held accountable by the broker to say, no, you need to get full pot for the listing, because the broker needs to get paid too, right? So there's so many hands in the cookie jar, the agent gets trapped and has to, you know, there's no money left, there's no meat on the bone anymore. So we created Indwell Real Estate for two reasons. Number one, to solve that problem by not taking the agent's money. And then number two, to be a place for agents to hang their license. We don't take their money. And then also, if they want to be investors, we can help them with that. And so we teach agents that want to learn and engage in the investment world. We help them with that. I mean, we're experts in it. We've been doing it for 20 years. And other brokers don't really do that. They definitely haven't bought, sold, and restored 1,000 houses. So we have a major edge on most brokerages for those two reasons. And for that reason, it became, in 3 years, became the largest independently owned brokerage in Fort Worth.
I mean, that's incredible to me. Yeah. And how many agents do you have associated with you guys now?
I think it's I don't know the exact count, but somewhere between 110 and 120 agents.
I mean, how in the world did you guys get from zero to, you know, over 100 in that matter of time? Like, what would attract them? Just that you weren't taking,
yeah, we weren't taking their money
out of their.
Well, that's pretty easy. That's pretty easy. Yeah. Sell, right? We're not going to take a commission. It's a flat fee. We're not going to take a commission. You keep all your commission. And the other piece is the broker, Will Wright. I mean, he is one of the most magnetic personalities in the world. People love Will. Imagine this, because I'm not a broker, but I own the broker, but I'm not a broker. But imagine owning a brokerage and having a broker and not ever getting any complaints. I have not one time in all these years have I gotten a call from an agent complaining about Will.
That's good job, Will. Great job. And I've met Will, and he's a great man, great guy. So good job, Will. Oh, we love him anyways.
My CFO's an Aggie too. He's brilliant. I love him.
Oh man. So,
anyway, yeah. So that's kind of the reason. The last and final reason that we built Indwell is we don't really. Indwell is the reason I call it a passion project is because we really don't make any money. It's a break-even brokerage. And it's, you know, it's owned by a real estate company that does a wide variety of things. Well, one of the things we can do is we can sell money to the Indwell agent's customers. In other words, we also have Merit Mortgage, which is our mortgage brokerage that has relationships with a dozen banks, and we can give the Indwell agent's clients great options, great approval options. So that's one way we monetize Indwell is by trying to create a nice synergistic relationship between Merit Mortgage and real estate. The other way is that we incentivize the agents to bring us houses for our portfolio. And we have a passive income thing for the agents. So if they refer a house to us, we buy it, restore it, we take all the risk. We give them a share of the interest for the life of the loan for sending us the deal, which is an incredible offer. I mean, nobody offers that. It's like they don't have to risk anything. All they had to do is make one phone call. And if we buy it, we restore it. Once we own our finance, we create a note, and then we give them a share of the interest spread for the life of the loan, which is,
I mean, it's incredible. I imagine you have a lot of them just interested in just absolutely participating in that. I mean, why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
It's passive. That's what we're all shooting for.
That's it. That's right. Make one phone call, make money for 30 years.
Well, do you guys have a cap on how many, what's your goal? Because I know you shoot high, you aim big. Like, what's your goal as far as, do you want a certain number of realtors associated with the NOR, or do y'all have a cap on it? How does that work?
We really don't. We don't do much marketing. We don't like promote it really hard because we don't want just anybody. They really have to fit our culture, and we protect that culture. We kick people out. We've fired people that didn't align with our values. The size is just, it is what it is. I mean, we added 4 agents last week.
Yeah.
It's a word of mouth thing. So there's not really we don't have a hard number that we're going for. And we're not, you know, we don't have a dedicated recruiter like most brokerages. We just don't. We believe instead of all of that, we believe that we can be a magnet. And that's worked for us so far.
Good job, guys. That's great.
Thanks.
Well, I want to talk. So I want you to tell me about Clutch Lending for a second, and then let's talk about SoberSys, which is Jennifer, your wife's business. I want to hear about that because I think we'd like to link to that as well. It sounds really awesome what she's doing there. And then let's dive into a little bit about some business questions. But tell me a little bit about Clutch Lending, SoberSys, and then we'll dive into a little bit of the guts of the business.
Okay, so we have two mortgage companies, Avocet Ventures, that holds all of our notes, right, for our owner finance company. Then we have Merit Mortgage, which does kind of mortgages for guys like you and Micah.
Okay.
Just kind of a normal retail mortgage situation. But I started Clutch Lending because I saw a pretty interesting niche, because the most common question I get from new investors or people that want to get in the business, because there's not a week that goes by where I hear from somebody, hey, I've always wanted to do that. I'm like, well, why don't you? Well, it's just really hard because, you know, banks won't lend you the money. And, you know, because banks really don't have an appetite to lend to a onesie twosie guy. You know, if you want to borrow a couple $100,000 from a bank like that, you better have $200,000 in your savings account. They're not going to do it. And so there's this vacancy in the asset-based or hard asset-based lending, which is, you know, slang for that is hard money loans.
Hard money.
Yeah, they're high interest loans, short-term. They're real fast, you know, and I'm an expert. I happen to be an expert on evaluating the collateral and how much it's going to cost to fix it. And so we created Clutch Lending so that we could service number one, our Indwell agents that want to invest, because you know, it's hard to get bank money. And so the goal with Clutch is to create a platform, or sort of a springboard, for people to get into a position to where they can get bank funding. So what we would do is we would come alongside somebody that wanted to do a deal. He goes and finds a deal, and then rehabs and sells it. Then he does it a few more times. Well, I want that guy. I mean, you don't really want to do business with Clutch for very long. You want Clutch to be a bridge to where you really want to go.
Right.
Because it's a high interest loan. I mean, it's a 12% loan with 3 points up front. Like, it's because it's risky for us, right?
Yeah, you bet.
It's totally risky. So I have to charge that interest, and I have to charge those points to cover myself in case the deal craps out. But my goal is to coach and come alongside these borrowers, right? The guys that are trying to get into the investment game, and make sure that they don't shoot themselves in the foot. So having me in their corner, in a way, increases the chances of success quite a bit. Now, we can't keep them from getting completely knocked out or poleaxed by something nobody sees, right? Because there's a million variables. But let me tell you, if you've bought, sold, and restored, I mean, bought, restored, and sold 1,000 houses, I've already made all the mistakes.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you'll just having you in the court and walking up and looking at the house with you, I mean, that's invaluable.
Yeah. And I don't want the new person. Right. And so a lot of hard money loan lenders will just say, if their LTV looks right and the borrower's ARV is off, the after restoration value is off, the hard money lender is still going to lend them money to go do the deal. And the hard money lender knows that they're not going to make any money. And I'm not going to allow that. I'm going to be like, don't do this deal. Here's three reasons why. Go find another one. I'll lend you the money to do it. No problem. But you're not going to make any money on this deal.
Yeah.
And here's why. So
what a blessing to have somebody tell you that.
Yeah, because I want to help these young guys and girls that are coming up in the business and want to build their own portfolio of owner finance notes or rental portfolio. And the best way to do that is to have a coach in your corner so that you don't kill yourself. And the reason I have such a passion for that is because, really, back to my retail days, I was totally isolated, totally alone.
Yeah.
And didn't have anybody to help me. And I didn't know how to ask for it. And so that's the idea behind clutch lending. And that's why we're doing this. It's really, and it's working already. We just started it 2 months ago and we've got a ton of money out on the street already, and it's working. So
I got a question, Craig.
Yeah.
So you got all these businesses, you got all these things going on all the time. As a business owner, someone that is going to start a new business or has a big idea and they're going to go do all this stuff, what advice would you give them on having space to do, like, de-stress, to relax a little bit? Because I know I'm a workaholic. I can be. My wife is a workaholic. We can just go and go and go. But I know at some time you can burn out and you can get, just disgruntled on the little things if you don't take that time out to kind of refresh, replenish your energy, all those kinds of things. How have you found that balance to not only work super, super hard, but also have that time to replenish your energy?
Yeah. I'm a little weird in this way, Micah. I thank God, but for some reason I have endless energy. That being said, so yesterday I was having a leadership meeting with our clutch team, and it was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon or 3:30. And Bobby looked at me, he goes, "Man, it looks like you're zoned out a little bit." And I was thinking, "You know what? I am." I said, "I am. My brain is mush. I need to go get on my bike and ride." And so I got up from the meeting. The meeting was over. It was hour and a half, a 90-minute meeting that we have every week. But, I mean, the truth of the matter is I'd been going since 4:30 that morning. So I'd almost put in a 12-hour day. It was only 3:30 in the afternoon. And, I work real hard. And I have this – I know when I'm done. Like, I know when I can't really work anymore. And so I do turn it off, but my brain forces me to turn it off, because for me to stay in that meeting and drink a cup of coffee and try to keep going and grinding more that's dumb for me anyway, because that's when I make mistakes, because I get lazy and tired.
But it's probably taken you a while, Craig, to get to the point of you realizing that about yourself. I mean –
Yeah, it is. It has. And
speak to that guy wanting to start something who's about to dive into it all and say, "Hey, be sure to do these things, or be sure to be careful for."
There's something Micah said I want to get back to before I get into that. And that is, you've got this great idea and you want to go kill it with that idea. And when you said the word idea, I was like, I need to talk about the idea. because the truth of the matter is, no matter how much you care about that idea, it's likely that no one else does.
Hmm.
And so before you double down and get excited about an idea, make sure the market gives a crap about your quote idea, because most of the time the market doesn't. And so it becomes this, before you even start a business, don't assume that if you build it, they will come, because they won't. They're busy doing their own thing and they don't care about your thing. And so doing a really good job on the front end of validating your idea on the front end is where I would spend most of the time, instead of, because I was like, you know, we can talk about how to rest, mm-hmm. but if you're wasting your time and energy on a bad idea, you know, to me, it starts with the idea. And if you've got a good idea, it fuels you, especially if the market likes your idea.
And you do that, like, how have you done that really done it well? Like checking ideas with the market?
Well, golly.
Is that polling friends?
Usually ask my wife and she tells me.
Asking family.
Well, you know, it's yes, it starts with those kind of things. But really the ultimate thing is whether or not people are willing to unhand their hard-earned money in exchange for your idea. And so you start real small to figure that out first before you build a bunch of widgets that nobody wants, or you build a whole system around what you think that they want. And that's the other thing, is that we misdesigned and dwell real estate on the front end because we pulled the heck out of agents, like 50 of them, 50 top producers, and tried to figure out what their needs were. And they decided this is, you know, for example, I really want somebody to take over transaction coordination, for example. And, you know, we start in Dwell, we get a bunch of realtors in there going, and it's like, and we realize that the things that we pulled and had on our bullet list wasn't actually what they wanted. And so even the polling it's important, but it's not the deciding factor. The deciding factor is when the customer is willing to unhand the cash to pay for your idea. And so you test the market with that first. Make 5 of those widgets and see if they sell. And then after they sell, or after the idea sells, you get you create a feedback loop so that you get feedback and know what parts of your idea sucks, which part needs improvement, which part needs to be adjusted, which part is important, which part isn't important, before you build 100 widgets. And so the rest question's important. But for an entrepreneur, it's way secondary. You don't need to be learning how to take a vacation. You need to be learning how to vet an idea.
That's good. Well, let's get in, and that phases into what I really want you to speak into about. You know, I personally talked to you and really saw counsel just on roles within the organization, structures, like people, like, you know, you don't learn this stuff in school, really. So this guy has an idea. This entrepreneur gets going, he tests it, it goes really well, he wants to make a business out of it. Like, fast forward him a little bit down the road, like, what does he need? What does his business need to look like as far as roles and the structure from your experience and what you've seen? What works and what doesn't?
I mean, somebody that has your same skill set because you think they're awesome and they're so smart, because they're smart in the same ways you are, is the dumbest thing you can do.
Oh, thanks.
You have to find somebody that annoys you a little bit. You have to find somebody that thinks completely different than you. And there's ways to do that. I mean, with data, like hard data, I use a tool called Culture Index. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you're applying for a role in my company, you're going to get a Culture Index survey, and we're going to look at your hardwired traits, kind of things that you're hardwired to do, and see if you're a match before we even talk to you.
You're going to be super selective on the front end, aren't you, at this point?
Oh, yeah. Because I've learned, I mean, hiring somebody because you like them, hiring somebody because they're friendly is stupid. I mean, you're burning money. You might as well just throw it in a trash can and burn it.
Yeah.
And so doing the front end work of hiring the right person is really important, and being willing to pay, right? Being willing to pay for the right person. And so I would look at where, and really being an entrepreneur is a journey in self-discovery, learning who you are, because the more accurate you are with who you are, the more accurate your personal self evaluation is, and your self-assessment is, the more successful you are going to be in surrounding yourself with people that fill your vacancies and ability, talent, and point of view. But you can't do that if you don't really know yourself. And I would say that most people don't.
And you've done a lot of personality. I wanted to ask you that. So mm-hmm. culture, you like the Enneagram. Mm-hmm. You've done DISC. I mean, what all have you done? What have y'all settled on? I know the culture is a little bit, they say it's the most objective, like, but yeah. However, it's kind of hard for the smaller guys to get into. I think maybe a little cost prohibitive, maybe not, but yeah. Tell me about personality tests. What can they do to get us, you know, to make the most bang for the buck, so to speak, just to make a step in that direction?
You know, I would start, like I was saying, I would start with by really getting to know yourself.
Okay, that's good.
That's number one, because if you don't know yourself, you're toast. You're gonna spin your wheels. You're gonna run out of gas. Really get to know yourself. Something that's free. This is the Enneagram. Study the Enneagram. Buy a few books about the Enneagram. Take the Enneagram test. Find out which of the nine numbers you are, and kind of explore it, because the Enneagram is a little bit too subjective for my taste. I love it, but it's pretty subjective, because you can say, well, I'm a number seven, and you're really not. You don't really know yourself, so you really aren't. And so it's really doing a deep dive study on who you are, and then getting people to give you some feedback on who you think you are, because who you think you are, you know, might not be what your wife thinks you are, or your business partner, or your associates, or your best friend. And so it's sort of like a journey of spending a year getting to know yourself, because it'll help you tremendously hiring your first person. I would definitely get to know yourself before you hire anybody. And that takes it, in my opinion, it takes a year, really good study, hard study, to figure that out. You can expedite that through assessments, through the DISC assessment and things like that. But what you'll find is that typically the typical entrepreneur is wired like me, where they're all gas, no brake. And that doesn't work. It works to start stuff. It doesn't work to maintain stuff.
And that's why I wanted to speak on your roles, because like you can start all day long, but without the Lee in our corner.
Right. Without Lee Ellis. Yeah. I'd have crashed and burned a long time ago. For sure. Again. But what's interesting is that all those couple million bucks I lost, which I paid back, by the way, but that money that I lost, I didn't file bankruptcy. I paid it back. And I just want to make that clear.
That's great.
Super. Wow. Like there's
that's a big, big deal.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, God dang, that was hard.
Yeah.
Two babies on the ground and a stay at home mom. Like, oh my gosh, I thought it was my house, my cars. It was freaking awful. So stressful. But anyway, Lee, I knew from that experience that I needed somebody. My blind spot was so obvious, that I knew I couldn't do it without someone like him. And I thought, who is the most detail oriented, meticulous person I know? And I called him and I had lunch with him. And
I mean, that all stemmed from you, like, knowing yourself.
Yeah. We would compare notes for our retail businesses, for example. We would compare notes. And his approach to business was totally different than mine. Very systematic, you know, really, really beautiful. And I'm like, and I was like, man, you know, when things got hard, I was like, and cash flow was tight, I wasn't in the spreadsheets. I was out on the floor going, I'm going to take that guy's credit card and run it extra. I'm going to upsell the crap out of this lady. You know, and I would just, because I'm a sales guy and I want to win, so I could sell myself out of these problems. Meanwhile, the details were chasing me down like a rabid dog and just attacked me and just chewed me up for $2 million. And so I knew I needed somebody to help. And Lee knew he needed an outside guy too. So it was a match made in heaven.
Just a great team. Yeah. But it all starts with that self-awareness too. I mean, if we just, we don't know that early on.
Yep.
You just don't.
It's the most important thing, really. I mean, and it may sound a little egotistical to say, well, why would I stare at my belly button? That's not what I'm talking about. I'm just talking about really getting to know yourself. Hire a therapist. Do some deep work.
Yeah.
And really work through who you are. It's the most important thing, because if you don't know who you are, you can't hire anybody that'll help you.
That's helpful advice, Craig.
At the end of the day, you're not everything. You can't be everything. Yeah. None of this stuff that I built by myself, like, no way. I'd have run all the businesses straight into the ground 100 times over if it wasn't for the team that's around me.
Well, let's fast forward. So that's good. That's super helpful. The entrepreneur, he knows himself. He knows his blind spots. He hires the right person. Like, what does he need to be looking for as far as, like, how to structure these things where they work? Or, you know, give us some kind of big lessons you learned, some keys, and then I want to talk to you about the perfect meeting. What does his business need to look like after, you know, after he's up and running? He's got his market. He's starting to make some money. He's got somebody who compliments. You know, is there certain things he needs to be watching out for, or certain things his business needs to look like? What's some tips you've learned along the life path of business operations?
I wouldn't borrow money. I would try to bootstrap. Sometimes you need a line of credit. But if you're cash strapped, that should be a red light, you know, kind of a warning light. A lot of businesses fail because they're underfunded. I thought my retail business was failing because I was underfunded, and I went and borrowed more and more and more and more, and I really had a bigger problem. That was that money wasn't going to solve. I mean, it was a big old toilet flushing it all down, right? And so I'd be real careful about debt. And then I'd be real careful about, if you do go into debt, who you're borrowing it from, because it's dangerous to borrow money from, and I've not done this, but borrow money from a private investor, because that money typically has an opinion about your business. So you got to be real careful about that. But once you're up and running and you feel like you've plateaued, you likely have a marketing issue. And so it becomes your branding and your messaging. And all of those things that sort of fuel the fire of your business. Nothing happens. No one makes money. No one listening to this has all the money in your wallet right now, as you listen to this, came as a result of somebody somewhere selling something. And selling is the most noble thing ever. And if you're not able to sell, you're toast. And so typically when businesses are plugging along and they want to scale, they have to do a couple of things. They have to either sell more of the same thing or get more money for that same thing, or get more customers, right? It's just a few different ways to scale. And so that's kind of how I see it. I also would be real careful about hiring a bunch of people, hoping that that will help too. We typically don't hire somebody until it's painful. We don't hire somebody until we know for sure it's costing us money not to have that person. We don't hire that person hoping to make more money because of that person. We hire people when it's pinching us. And
that's good. That's
good. Yeah, because cash flow is important. And if you're operating in negative cash flow, you know, you can work as hard as you want. It just sucks.
That's good.
Many, many years. I know what negative cash flow feels like. It's the worst.
Well, that's what I was about to say. Somebody who's been there and done that and, like, had realized how important that is. Mm-hmm. So I have been around one of your regular weekly kind of exec meetings. You guys have all your role, the certain roles. These guys are reporting on objectives and goals, and you're running at this point a very effective meeting, a very effective organizations. That doesn't happen automatically. So can you speak on the what you call the L10 meeting?
Yeah.
Can you speak on like how to run a good meeting? How have y'all developed that, and what's important, the key ingredients in those things?
Sure. Well, we've done a version of this for years and years, but we are the kind of a template or the operating system we use, the EOS, which stands for Entrepreneurial Operating System. And it is, in my opinion, it's the best. Like you can't beat it. It's simple and straightforward. It holds everybody accountable. It keeps the meetings engaging and interesting. And there's several books that revolve around the Entrepreneurial Operating System. And the book, the one of the best books for entrepreneurs as it relates to the EOS is called Rocket Fuel, and it describes the dynamic between Lee and I, my business partner, I, mm-hmm. perfectly, where you've got a visionary that's bigger, better, faster, looking for the wins. The outside guy goes out and kills it and drags it back, and then you've got the integrator who holds the visionary accountable and make sure the visionary doesn't twist off and go the wrong direction. But more importantly, holds the company accountable. So he leads and manages and holds everyone accountable to the objectives and the picture of the business. So Rocket Fuel is a good read. And then Traction is the other book. I think it's a Wickman book. I can't remember mm-hmm. who wrote it, but I think it's Wickman.
I think you're right. Yep.
You can link it to the show
notes. We'll link it.
Anyway, excellent. Excellent, excellent book, excellent read, incredibly good way to run your business. And I would say that if you're building your business to sell your business, and let's say you're kind of mid-phase, you're growing, everything's good, there are people out there that look and seek businesses that are run using this operating system. I mean, tens of thousands of businesses. And if I was looking to buy a business that has been running EOS,
you're looking at that one.
You're dang right.
So is this stuff that important though, Craig? I mean, because I think for a lot of people, you do get caught up working in your business. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it that important to spend the time like determining the roles, determining the structure, working on the meetings, like,
yeah.
or is that a waste in your time?
Yeah, good question. Well, it depends. I mean, if you wanna just be a solopreneur, work your fingers to the bone and be the main man, have at it. That's not what I want to do. Mm. I want to build a big business, and I don't want to build a big business to line my own pockets. I want to build a big business because it helps so many of the families that work under the umbrella upon the platform of what I've envisioned. That's my passion. That's what I love. And having structure matters. People feel good with structure. If you don't have structure and you don't have boundaries, you don't have accountability, people are unhappy with that. They really want, including me, I mean, everybody wants these boundaries and the structure to operate in. They know what success means. They know what failure means. They know that there's a, yes, it just yeah. be organized. You can't wing it and really grow.
Yeah.
And if you think for a second that it doesn't matter, you're going to stay stuck. You're going to just stay where you are, or you're going to burn real bright and then crash and burn. Mm-hmm. So structure and organization really matters. It'll kill you if you don't do it.
And do the meetings the way you do meetings? In your experience, based on how you're operating now, those meetings, like what's included in them, how they're done, is that important? Because you've been in business long enough to know people and employees will be, I don't want to do another meeting, or you know, whatever. So let's talk on that for a minute, and we're getting close to getting wrapped up.
Yeah, for sure. So I hate meetings more than anything in the world. I hate them. And
that's the sentiment for a lot of people, probably.
Yeah, I hate them. I hate them. And I would say I really love meetings now. I used to hate them because I didn't know what I was doing. EOS gave structure to it and just helped me. And now I love them because it's like, I know for sure it's going to start on time. I know exactly when it is. I know it's going to end on time. And I know we're going to get a lot of stuff done, and we're never going to talk in circles. We're going to identify problems. We're going to discuss problems, and we're going to solve problems. And then we're going to have to-dos to solve them in the next 7 days.
And that's some of your key components within those meetings.
Yes.
You're identifying the ones, you're solving them, you're discussing them.
Yep. And we hold each other accountable. So if I start talking in circles, anyone in the meeting can say, Craig, you're talking in circles. What's the issue? You haven't even identified the issue. What is specifically the issue? So it forces me to give the actual issue. Here's the issue. Okay, so now let's discuss it. Okay, now let's solve it. And then we build to-dos and hold everybody accountable, because typically most problems aren't solved by one person. They're solved by two or three departments. And so it enables us to stay in our lanes and to go faster.
That's good, Craig. And they get a little hot sometime in there?
Hell yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess that would be a mark of a good meeting too.
Oh, yeah.
You have to have the healthy conflict.
If you're not swapping paint, you're not getting anything done. So, yeah. But we do it respectfully, and we honor each other, and we're kind. But, yeah, they get heated for sure.
That's great, Craig. Tell me about SoberSys, and then I want to ask you one final question or two, and then we're going to wrap it up. Thank you for your time. But let's talk about Jennifer for a second and what cool things she's doing with women.
Yeah, so Jennifer, when the kids were teenagers, she was drinking a little more wine than she wanted to at night. And, she wasn't an alcoholic. She didn't get a DWI, but she was just drinking more than she wanted to drink. She was like, what the heck? This sucks. I don't want to do this. God, take this wine glass out of my hand.
Yeah.
And, God doesn't really answer prayers like that most of the time. He wants you to do your part. And so she went to work and tried to figure it out, went online, bought some programs and read a bunch of books, listened to endless podcasts on alcohol and the effects and all this stuff. And she solved it for herself. And she decided she wanted to help other women do the same. And so she created a movement, we call it a tribe of women that are looking to renegotiate their relationship with alcohol. And it's called SoberSys.
And you can find that online.
Yes,
kind of everywhere.
At SoberSys on Instagram. She's got I got like 500 followers and she has 25,000 or something, It's like,
That's just how it is.
She's a full on middle-aged influencer. I mean,
she's great.
Almost 50 years old. And, she has an alcohol reset where women can join her $97 21-day alcohol reset. And they get an email every day and encouragement. She unpacks the science behind what alcohol is doing, what the industry of alcohol is doing, and how to beat it. And she teaches people to renegotiate their relationship with alcohol. That's what she does every day, all day. We're empty nesters now. The kids are gone. And she is, that girl works harder than I do, for sure.
And I know you're proud of her, and that's exciting. So great job on that, Jennifer. Yeah. So you have a podcast called True Grit. I personally listen to nearly all of them. I love them. You have great guests.
Yeah.
So where else can people listening connect with you?
Oh, CraigCouch.com, TrueGritPodcast.com. They all go to the same place. That's
okay.
The best way. And then it's just my name on Instagram.
People
can reach me that way too.
That's great, Craig. Well, let me wrap it up with this. I want to know a couple of habits or routines just that you developed over your life that you think, man, these work for a lot of people and have really impacted me in a big way. Like people need to be doing some of these if it works for them, like this routine or whatever this habit is, and just in life. Is there anything that just jumps off the top of your head, whether it's reading, journaling, whatever,
Yeah. I mean, so if you set aside the regular things of reading books and listening to podcasts, because if you're not doing that, you're not growing, in my opinion. You're missing out. The Bible as being the number one source of incredible operating system for running your business in your life, for sure. But the one thing that jumps out to me is writing. It's been a recent, the last 2 years of my life. And I use writing to think. It's how I think. I reassure myself with writing. I encourage myself with writing. I straighten out my thoughts with writing. I wrestle with things with writing. And then I happen to publish it as well. I mean, I send out an email a couple of days a week where it's actually me working out different leadership principles and ideas out loud. And
people can get on those. And I'm a subscriber. And I don't know, I've commented to you several times, like, that is so deep. Like, where did you know? So I'm personally, you know, as a business owner too, I'm personally just encouraged and fueled by that. So they can get on your website.
GregCouch.com
and subscribe to that as well.
Yeah. And if you hate something I write, let me know. And if you love something I write, let me know.
Yeah. He likes it either way. It doesn't matter. Feedback is good.
I do. Cause I mean, some of the stuff I write is like, might be crazy. Change my mind. I'm open. You know, I'm just trying to learn here. And that writing I do is me learning out loud. And it's changed the way I'm able to articulate things as well. It's made me more verbally articulate because of my writing. And so I think it's really, really helpful. It's really helped me a lot. It's a big part of my routine.
That's great, Craig. Yeah. Craig, thank you. Thank you. There's so much in here. So we'll have to sweet talk you back one day. And thank you for being our first guest and the wisdom you brought. And we look forward to following you and watching all the stuff that you're doing. And listen to all your podcasts. So True Grit, and go to Craig Couch and you can connect with him and look, you know, Indwell Real Estate and all his other businesses. So thank you, Craig. We're super grateful.
Josh is great.
Have a great day.
Thank you so much.
Hey, this is Micah. Me and Josh would like to thank you for joining us in the Story Field today. We hope you've enjoyed our discussion, and to learn more about us and The Story Field, visit thestoryfield.com. This podcast is sponsored by The Allen Firm, legal guides for many of life's situations. To learn more about The Allen Firm, visit allenlawfirm.com. Have a blessed day, week, and year, and we will see you next time on The Story Field.